The following is an encore episode of Hour One of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Turley Frequency with Kevin Turley, a show for you and by you. The phone lines are open, so call now at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881 and share with us your thoughts and prayer intentions as we navigate this complicated world together. And now your host of the Turley Frequency, Kevin Turley.
Hello and welcome to the Turley Frequency. Yes, live and exclusive here on Archangel Radio, broadcasting to you on 1410 AM and 94.5 FM. Right across Lower Alabama and throughout the Archdiocese of Mobile. My name is Kevin Turley, and I'm your host for the next 2 hours of conversation, of prayer, of storytelling, and hopefully of good cheer in this season of joy. I keep talking about joy so much, I think to myself, well, you need to cheer up. So I'm doing my best. It's Monday morning. How are you? Now, if you're listening to me stuck in a road traffic, feel free to give me a ring, 888-928-0881, or text me on 251-928-2111. If you're sitting in traffic and it's slow moving or not moving at all, why don't you just give me a ring? Tell me what it's like. Tell me that you are offering it up for something, someone, or even for the success of this show. Wouldn't that be good? Now, talking of success, in the next segment, we have a science fiction author. Yes, a real live science fiction author is coming in to speak to us. He's award winning and he's produced so many books that when I started counting them this morning, I couldn't believe how many entries he had on the Goodread website. But that's all coming up later with John C. Wright coming down the line from Virginia in the next segment, which got me thinking, sci-fi. Do you like it? Do you read it? Do you watch it? I have to say that one of my earliest memories is Star Trek. That's right. Even this side of the Atlantic, it must have been about 68, 69, watching it on television. It must have been broadcast for the first time on British television. And I remember sitting watching it and been absolutely fascinated by it. I mean, I was very, very small at the time, so I've got no idea what I would have made of the plot lines, and I probably made absolutely nothing of them. But you know, when you're that age as a child, you're fascinated by sort of colors on the walls, that sort of thing. So Star Trek is one of my earliest memories. When I was thinking about this morning's interview, I suddenly realized how much sci-fi movies, less so literature — I'm not a great fan of sci-fi literature, though don't tell John that when he comes on — but sci-fi movies have really become part and parcel of our culture. And I was wondering, what is your favorite sci-fi movie? Why don't you text me and tell me, 251-928-2111, or call in and tell me that you're a huge sci-fi fan, and here's a list of your favorite movies, books, authors, and all the rest. But just think about it. I mean, films which really kind of catch the psyche of the times. In the 1980s, it was films like E.T. Do you remember that? Of course, it was Star Wars in the 70s, and then E.T. in the 80s, Back to the Future. I mean, these are all sort of sci-fi movies, as well as in recent times we've had all those kind of Interstellar and The Martian and all these very serious movies about space and space exploration. And sci-fi is a genre which seems to have more suburbs than the average U.S. city. There's any amount, whether it's dystopian stuff like 1984, or whether it's space age stuff like some of the stuff I talked about, other universes, other galaxies, space travel, or whether it's kind of alternate realities in this world. The genre seems to be completely malleable and is very, very popular. However, there is an element of snobbery amongst the media and the literary elite around the whole issue of sci-fi is something which is often seen as fan fiction, something for the masses, but not really very serious. That's changing a bit, but why don't you tell me what you think? I'd be interested to know. Now, talking of alternate realities, I'm sure America at the weekend was watching the exploits of its football team in the FIFA Soccer World Cup. I have to be careful what I say. Soccer World Cup. It's no longer football.
Soccer.
And Well, I mean, Mike, I hesitate to turn to you in your hour of darkness, but how was it?
Listen, Kevin, I'm gonna be realistic. I didn't expect us to make it as far as we did, or at least very far to the World Cup. It pretty much met my expectations. I was sad to know that I was off on the score. I thought we at least had a chance against the Netherlands. I mean, look, you always have a chance, but I predicted the score wrong. I only got one score right the whole time, and that was against Iran. I'll take my earnings and anyway, no, I think I predicted that the U.S. would win like 2-1. At least got our score right. We only scored one goal, but congratulations to the Netherlands, and maybe in 4 years we'll get some better players and field a better team and try to make a run at this thing for once. But
I have to say, Mike, you have on Friday you morphed into the stereotype of every single football fan in Europe. And let me explain what I mean by that. No matter what the match is, they always predict, going to a fan before the match, they will always predict their win by, you know, whatever it happens to be, 2 goals, 3 goals, whatever, whatever, whatever. And of course, the reality often bites along the way. I mean, the predictions, as you know, England won at the weekend, which was, probably a little bit more predictable. But listening on the radio to some of the predictions, all the English fans were saying 3-0, 3-0, 3-0. So, I mean, but it would have been 3-0 no matter who they were playing. I mean, they're playing France, I think, next weekend. We are the world champions, and it'll be England who are going to win 3-0. So I wouldn't feel any, I mean, that's the normal default for fans. I mean, because you want your team to win. I mean, a fan who comes on and says, I think we'll get beaten 3-0, is either very depressed or very realistic. Take your choice. So
that's what I have to
now,
say
listen,
about that.
But tell me this. Does this mean that the soccer ball, the soccer strip, the soccer flags are all now placed in a large trunk for the next 4 years? Is that the end of it, do you think, for the United States?
For the time being, yes. I mean, I don't know when we're going to when the USA team will regroup to practice and prepare, but hopefully we have that mindset, for the next. Hopefully that feeling will sink in. You know, you want to learn. Coach Saban, which is Alabama's football coach, always says, learn from your failure. So hopefully, we'll take this loss and we'll learn a lot from it and we'll have much more success next time.
Well, yeah.
But again, it's all about the Jimmies and the Joes. You got to have the right players.
Yeah.
So.
It would have definitely helped on Saturday, though, if they'd taken the crash helmets off.
If they what?
If they'd taken the crash helmets off. I think that would have definitely helped. And stopped handling the ball. No. Listen, Mike. It's a minor footnote in U.S. sporting history. There'll always be tulips in Amsterdam awaiting the United States football team. They'll be celebrating every time they turn up. So, what's your prediction for who's going to win it? Is there any further insights into this? Do you have a new team that you're rooting for?
I'm gonna go. I think that Argentina will win. Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, Messi is the best player in the world. He and was it Cristiano Ronaldo? Mm-hmm. Those are the best two players. But I think I think Messi will get it done. I know they fell short 4 years ago, right?
Yeah, he messed up then.
I didn't have my little sound effect on cue on time there, but. No, I think that they'll get it done.
Well, let's hope it's don't cry for me, Argentina. Whenever they're playing, England v France. What's your prediction there? It's Waterloo all over again.
I think I'm going to go with France on this one. It's hard to beat. I mean, listen, we're France is the team that won it last time, right? So, and we tied England nil.
That's right.
You know, at nil.
That's
and
right.
So, I just think that I just think that France is too much of a power. They it's hard to beat a champ, you know.
It's hard to beat
a reigning champ. And it's also but it's also hard. Listen, it's also hard to beat a team twice. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I'm going to go with France on that.
Of course, France were a great help to you during the Revolutionary Wars.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, listen, I just had a text in about favorite sci-fi movies. Before I read that out, do you have any skin in this game? Do you have any favorite sci-fi movies?
I mean, listen, I'm like the most of the USA here. I'm going to go with Star Wars as my favorite. Yeah.
What the whole how many sequences are there now? There are about 20 episodes or something.
All right. I don't know. There's branch offs of various of the series. You know, you got the Andor one that's now on Disney Plus, and then you had there've been so many breakoffs, branches, and then you had the Mandalorian, that was another branch of the whole Star Wars.
I thought that was a car.
You had as far as the Star Wars in the series, as far as the series goes, I'm gonna say the first one, A New Hope. I like that one.
I hated the way they did that, you know, because I can remember when Star Wars came out, whatever they're calling it these days, the first one in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
And I remember going with my brothers and we queued up and we went in and watched it. And, you know, it was a little bit above our heads. We were still quite young, so we didn't really get a lot of it. But now they call it something else. You know, they don't call it Star Wars. They call it the New Hope or the New This or New Whatever, part of this franchising idea. But this is one of the things about sci-fi. You know, they don't seem to have one film anymore. You know, things sort of multiply. You know, like Star Trek was a TV series and a very good one, but it only ran for, I think, two seasons or something. But today there's any amount of Star Trek films, spin-offs, future adventures, next generations, further generations. I mean, this is one of the things about sci-fi. It just seems to breed. You know, you leave it for 5 minutes and there's 20 more of them.
Let me ask you, Kevin. Did you have the Spock ears? Was that a thing?
Personally?
Yeah. No.
Are you asking a personal question? just because I'm on radio, you're saying that I'm ugly. Is that what you're saying, Mike? Can we get a caller, please? Because I've had enough of these insults. don't try and butter me up with the sound effects.
I
have Spock ears? No, my ears are normal, Mike. I had six operations to get them normal, but they're not normal.
Oh, you're killing me.
No, we never had Spock ears. Are you talking about kids like to put
on
your
ears? Kids, the toys.
No, Spock ears was a kind of cry of insult at school. Some kids, if you said you were a bit, or if somebody was a Spock at school, it meant that they were rather serious and studious. They're probably a good student, and they were known as Spock, you know.
Right.
So I mean, but it's interesting how it has completely entered our sort of modern way of thinking and talking. I mean, William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy must be two of the most famous actors in the world, even though they just appeared in these TV shows. It's funny, I was listening to an interview with William Shatner on the radio, it was a New York radio station, I think just about a month ago. And it was a very, very poor interview. And I'll tell you, the person interviewing William Shatner came out of the blocks in the wrong way. Because he immediately started speaking to William Shatner about something about how did he feel about getting the part in Star Trek? Something like that, right?
Right.
And William Shatner rightly said, you do realize this was like 53, 54, no, 55 maybe years ago.
Yeah.
And he's done quite a few things since.
Oh, yeah.
And you could just feel the weariness, the tiredness. He's been asked this a million times. And the interview sort of went the way of the ghost after that. But so you would plump for Star Wars as your favorite movie, sci-fi movie.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with that one.
Okay, our texter has come in.
You know, the other one, there's one more that I really liked.
Oh, yeah?
I completely forgot about it, and it was called The Abyss. And it came out, like, I think the early to mid-90s, and it's about this, scientific crew that goes deep underwater, and they discover this this alien that lives underneath, deep in the abyss. So I don't remember the details of it, but it was really, really solid. So that would be my other favorite if I had to go with one.
Well, our texter has said The Matrix.
Okay, all right.
Which was a pretty interesting. That has entered our lexicon of the 21st century as well. We're all living in the Matrix. The other one from our texter is a classic, and I'd forgotten about it until she mentioned it. Planet of the Apes.
Oh, yeah.
Planet, the original with Charlton Heston and that famous, iconic final scene. You know the bit I'm talking about, Mike?
It's been a while since I've seen that one, The Planet of the Apes.
So Planet of the Apes, as we all know, is about a space mission from the Earth crashing
right.
on a planet, which seems to be Earth, but the gorillas or whatever, the apes are running the place, and they treat the human astronauts very badly. Anyway, the whole thing is about trying to get off the Planet of the Apes back to Earth. And there's a bit where he's sort of escaping down this beach somewhere on horseback. And as he's riding then, the camera focuses in on Charlton Heston's face because he stops stunned on his horse, and he gets off the horse and he breaks down, he kneels down, he starts crying and weeping. And then the camera comes from behind and you can see what he's looking at. And what he's looking at is the Statue of Liberty submerged in the sea, with the sand around it. So they're on Earth. It's one of the best bits of film, and that's the end of the film. Sorry if anybody hasn't seen it, by the way. It's one of the best bits of sort of film cyclical here. But don't worry if you haven't seen it, because it goes into part two and part three, and it was various spin-offs. As I say, these sci-fi movies, they never have one. They have two or three. Other people are texting in saying Star Trek, Star Wars. Yes, these are all now. These things have become part of who we are. Star Trek, Star Wars, Back to the Future, E.T., Call Home. I mean, how many times have people used all these words from the sci-fi? Now, when John C. Wright comes on after the break, I'll be speaking to him about literary sci-fi, but also about some of these cinematic ones, but also asking him about a spiritual aspect to them, because one of the things that's often underappreciated is the spiritual nature of some of the sci-fi genre. Okay, so when we come back, we've got John C. Wright on the line. Any questions, call in. Back after these words.
John C. Wright we have on the phone today. Very much a great author he is.
Yes, he is very good. But we also have Kevin Turley, who will introduce John Wright. Isn't that right? Kevin Turley.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Star Wars. Yes, that's the music of Star Wars, and we are doing a sci-fi theme today. That's right. We are going intergalactic, and it's my great pleasure to welcome John C. Wright to the program. He is a retired attorney, newspaper man, newspaper editor, who he says was only once on the lam and forced to hide from the police at one point. We'll go into that maybe at some point. Anyway, after a distinguished academic career, he graduated from the College of William and Mary's Law School, where he became a lawyer. However, this didn't prove a great great success, and he went on to become a newspaper man, which he also says wasn't a great success, but he soon found success in the world of sci-fi and writing about sci-fi. He was a Nebula Award-winning finalist for the fantasy novel Orphans of Chaos, and just for those who don't know, the Nebula Award for the best novel is given each year by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America for the very best in science fiction or fantasy novels. When he published his debut novel, which was The Golden Age, a book I have read, Publishers Weekly called him, quotes, this fledgling century's most important new SF science fiction talent. He is on the line now from Virginia. John, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Thank you for having me. I'm a pleasure to be here.
Listen, when I went to do some research on the amount of novels that you were written, I was absolutely amazed. I went to the website Goodreads, which I'm sure you know, and it said on that that you had 110 distinct works. Is that correct? Have you published 110 books? You must have.
I have not published 110 books. I've published 38 books, but I have many short stories. So I don't know how Goodreads is actually counting it.
But even at 38, and you only started at the start of this century, that's quite a haul, even by any standards.
And by the way, I should say, if I may, the Publishers Weekly comment was meant a little tongue-in-cheek. At the time when they wrote that, in January of the first century, the new century was only 2 weeks old. So they were saying, in effect, that I was the greatest author of the last 2 weeks. It's a bit of a joke.
John, as a former newspaper man, you know it's always about printing the legend. So the facts, don't let the facts get in the way of a good quote. But listen, tell me
go ahead.
No, sorry, go.
No, I was saying go ahead. I was interrupting you. You weren't interrupting me.
Good. Well, look, I mean, you have quite an interesting CV, resume, before you ever got anywhere near a sci-fi novel. So Was writing something you always wanted to do, writing novels?
Yes, I knew that I wanted to be a science fiction writer since I was roughly the age of 12. The only reason why I went into law school and later had a failed legal career was because I was trying to get a second source of income to support me while I wrote books.
It's a well-worn path, I think, that, or a well-worn tale about people who are creative, who are forced into non-creative avenues, and they never work, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So why sci-fi? I mean, of all the genres in all the world, why did you have to pick sci-fi?
Because it is the one that gives the most scope for the reader's imagination to explore the unknown. If you write any other form of fiction, a love story, a railroad story, a pirate story, a courtroom drama, and you set it either here on Earth or in the recent historical past, then you can't look at human nature from the outside, as it were. You can't look at things given an entirely different premise of what the universe is and what it's going to be. For example, if I wanted to have someone make an observation about human nature, and I wanted to make it not from a human point of view, I have to introduce a character who's not a human being. It's got to be a robot or a Martian or something. Well, you can only do that in science fiction. And any other genre, you have to set the story in a world that works by the rules as we know them here. But if you want to explore what things would be like under other conditions, in other years, in other generations in the future, or even in worlds of magic or worlds of the imagination, science fiction allows you to change the rules and to see what the other outcomes might be. You know, what if there was time travel? Does that mean would it be lawful to go back and murder your grandfather? You know?
Well, look, I mean, I take my hat off to any science fiction writer. I have dabbled, I've dipped my toe into the world of fiction. Most of my writing has been nonfiction, but I have dipped my toe into the world of fiction. And I have to say, John, that fiction writing is the hardest form of writing.
It differs from man to man, quite honestly. I write by inspiration. A muse comes, she tells me to write. I just take dictation.
Well, it's your gift. I mean, and it is a gift. I mean, you must come across a lot of people who want to be novelists who don't have that gift.
almost all writers want to be novelists, but I myself do not know who has the gift and who does not, because there are many things that I would not think worthy of publishing that turn out to be someone else's favorite book of the world, their book of gold that will live in their imagination, in their golden imagination, for all their life. So I'm not really one to judge as to who is going to be worthy of writing and who is not. I myself think it's mostly perspiration and not mostly inspiration. If you want to be a writer and all you have to do is do that and do nothing else, ignore your wife and family and make sure that your job goes undone, all your chores go undone, and really stay up all night writing, eventually you'll become a writer. That's my theory.
Yes, now, I mean, it's the old idea that writers are people that write as opposed to talking about writing. And you probably know I think it's a P.G. Woodhouse quote that when asked, he used to get a lot of letters from aspiring writers, and he would say the first lesson is apply the seat of the pants to the chair. I know what he means. It's about getting down to writing. But listen, let's try and for the audience.
Let me interrupt to say the way I phrase it, Woodhouse is smarter than me, but the way I phrase it is I say, writing is courage in the face of the horror of blank paper. If you can look at blank paper without being intimidated, you can be a writer.
Do you have any tips for people that are intimidated by the blank page?
I'm afraid not, because it's something that's never happened to me.
Don't worry.
I wish I did.
I think you intimidate the paper the other way around. But listen, John, let's try, I know this is difficult, right? But let's try and define what the sci-fi genre, are there any boundaries to it? It seems to be everything and anything these days.
I don't know about these days, but I myself say that I have a very clear definition, which is science fiction is the mythology of a scientific age. Any genre is defined by the protocols or the assumptions the reader is going to bring to the book, so that the writer and the reader have an unspoken, unwritten contract, an agreement that the storyteller is going to tell a story and it's going to fit the protocols the reader expects from it. So that if you're writing a detective story, you expect the murder to be solved by the end of the story, and you expect it to be solved fair and square by the rules of detective writing. Likewise, in a love story, they might die tragically, but you expect the guy and the girl to be in love at the end of it. You expect them to overcome the obstacles in front of it. Well, in science fiction, the same expectations apply. You still have to have plot, theme, mood, lyricism, and so on and so forth. The only difference is you have to have world building. You have to make up the background of the world as to how your world is different from the fields we know. You see, you either have to have your hero taken to another planet, or you have to have something from another planet taken here. Unless you're writing fantasy, in which case you have to have your hero go to Elfland, or have something from Elfland go here. In either case, what the science fiction reader expects, that no other reader expects, is for you to treat logically with whatever the unreal assumption is. The reader expects you to carry out what the logical implications of that are. So if you say that pigs can fly, then logically in your world, a pig sty would have to have a roof on it so the pig doesn't fly away. You know, people would carry sturdy umbrellas in case of pig droppings, and so on and so forth.
So by extension then, John, every single sci-fi writer sets the rules of their own game.
Correct.
Right.
Now, they don't have to make it up themselves. They can write in a tradition of someone else has established.
That's true. That is true. You're listening to John C. Wright here live on the Turley Frequency on Archangel Radio. He is a much, much published and much praised sci-fi writer who is talking to us about all things sci-fi. And you can speak to John on 888-928-0881, or you can text me a question for John if you have one on 251-928-2111. It's interesting what you're saying there about world building, John, because I think you've created your own universe, haven't you, in the body of your work?
Once per story, usually, yes.
And what are the sort of, I mean, are they similar, these worlds, or do you try to make them very distinct from each other in per volume?
I don't know how to answer that, because I write both fantasy and science fiction. And my hard science fiction, I try very carefully to make it as scientifically accurate as our current speculations can allow. But when I'm writing space opera, I try to make it as gigantic and splendid and as gripping as I can. So let me back up and say, when I write science fiction, I use the same method that C.S. Lewis did, where a picture appears in my imagination, an image, and then other images, and then I try to link them together logically to form a plot, you see. So I don't sit down and decide, today I'm going to write a hard science fiction story with no faster-than-light drive, because I regard faster-than-light drive as a fantasy. Or I go, well, today I'm going to write a time travel story, even though time travel, if you think about it, is logically absurd and impossible. You know, writing a time travel story is like drawing an Escher painting where the staircase leads back to the beginning of the staircase again and nothing makes sense, you know. Mm-hmm. Every part of the picture in an Escher drawing makes sense, but the whole picture makes no sense, and that's what a time travel story is like. Well, neither of those things are hard science fiction. None of those things are scientifically accurate, but they take place in a science fiction-flavored background, and they're science fiction. Star Wars is science fiction, even though it has wizards and sword fights in it, right?
That's right. And even the likes, I guess, of Terry Pratchett is science fiction. I mean, even though it's lashings of humor, really, and satire.
Well, I believe, I spoke earlier about the protocols of what the reader expects. I think that comedy readers and horror readers are much more generous with what they'll let you get away with in terms of whether it makes sense or not. The comedy reader will let you get away with it as long as it's funny, and the horror reader will let you get away with it as long as it's horrific, you see?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the science fiction reader will let you get away with it as long as it expands his imagination, and that's what he's looking for.
Right. So would you suggest then that readers of science fiction are the most imaginative and appreciative type of readers?
Yes.
Wow. Talk to me about the difference between fantasy and science fiction, because I'm a bit confused now. What's the difference, or what do you understand as the difference? It's a subgenre. Is fantasy a subgenre of science fiction ultimately?
No. Both of them spring from the same root. At about the time in the Victorian era, when men... The average reading public became aware that technological changes would make it so that their grandchildren would live in a different world than the world they knew. Mm-hmm. And they regarded that prospect, some of them with joy and gladness, and some of them with horror and despair, as you mm-hmm. might expect, because these are the only two real relations we can have to the unknown, hope and despair. One of which, by the way, is a virtue, and the other of which, by the way, is a sin, but never mind that. So if you write a hopeful book about the future, you'll write H.G. Wells' Men Like Gods, which or Things to Come, which predicts utopia. And if mm-hmm. you're in despair, you're going to write Aldous Huxley or George Orwell's story mm-hmm. of future dystopias. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also going to regret the past you left behind, where the world was more alive and more magical, and if I may use the word, more sacramental. And by sacramental, I mean that there are visible realities that express an invisible reality. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like Professor Tolkien's book. Fantasy is that nostalgic attempt to portray the mood and the flavor of the world we lost. And it's different from a historical book because the magic is real. People in the Middle Ages believed in witches. They believed witches are real. Okay? So witchcraft is going to work in a fantasy book. There's going to actually be wizards and dragons and stuff. And the dragon is not going to be just a myth. It's going to be an actual creature. It's going to be, either a diabolical, demonic creature, if it's a Western dragon, or a wise, powerful spirit, if you're Ursula K. Le Guin, and you write Wizard of Earthsea, and you want to put a Oriental dragon into a Western story. Her dragons were Oriental dragons, because she was a bit of a Taoist, Miss Le Guin.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating that so Tolkien is ultimately the beginning of the fantasy genre, do you think?
Absolutely not. He is like a mountain that dominates the landscape, but mm-hmm. the beginning was William Morris.
Really?
An author that I'm not sure you've heard of, but he invented the Morris chair. He was one of the Pre-Raphaelites.
No, I've absolutely heard of William Morris. I was aware of him as a Pre-Raphaelite. I wasn't aware that he was dabbling in writing. I guess it's not that far, though, from some of his Pre-Raphaelite and his friends and their faux medievalism. It's not that far to construct your own Middle Earth from that that basis.
If you want to say fantasy is faux medievalism, you wouldn't be too far off. Although the second mountain dominating the landscape, besides Professor Tolkien, is the kind of blue-collar fantasy, as I will call it, the lower-class fantasy, which is Robert E. Howard in the Conan stories.
Yes.
And
yes,
that,
yes.
That kind of, that was nostalgic not for the medieval world, but for the classical world and for the barbaric world earlier than that. And that's where and those are the basic genres of science fiction. And there's the guards on the boundaries of the empire are not very watchful, so you can cross back and forth between fantasy and science fiction, and no one will really notice. But very few fantasy readers don't also like science fiction. Very few science fiction readers also don't like fantasy, because they use many of the same protocols and they appeal to the same desire to exercise the imagination for worlds other than the world we know. The basic difference is science fiction is extraterrestrial and fantasy is otherworldly, if I may.
Yes, wonderful. You're listening to John C. Wright, science fiction and fantasy writer, award-winning, and also a Catholic. And when we come back, we'll be exploring more of this genre and also speaking more about his own journey. You're listening to the Turley Frequency here on Archangel Radio, and we will be back straight after these words.
Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
Yes, welcome back to the Turley Frequency, broadcasting to worlds as yet unknown. And my very special guest is author, sci-fi author, fantasy author, John C. Wright. John, who were your influences growing up? Who were the authors that really shaped your imagination?
Have you read any of my books?
I've read The Golden Age.
Okay. The guys that shaped my imagination were the guys that you can clearly see that I'm copying with no trace of conscience. A. E. Van Vogt was my favorite author when I was young, and his widow, allowed me to write a sequel to his most famous book, my favorite book by my favorite author I got a chance to write. It was called Nulli Continuum, and it was a more than a dream come true, because when I was younger, I never actually dreamed of being able to write in his background. I also wrote a short story for a Jack Vance homage anthology. Jack Vance is another author that I truly, truly admire, even though he's a little cynical for me. And I'm sorry to say that Robert Heinlein was also a big influence on me. And the reason I'm sorry to say that is because he preached in a book that's not called Stranger in a Strange Bed. He preached against monotheism and monogamy. And
that's right.
He basically lied to a child, and I don't really, I wish I could forgive him for that, but I don't.
Yes.
But he had a nice Hemingway-esque style and an easy way of introducing imaginative elements into his story quite nonchalantly that any writer would be wise to, both science fiction and non-science fiction, would be wise to copy. So those were the major influences, and I should also mention Keith Lalmer wrote action-adventure stories in a very brisk and masculine style, and I rather admire his methodology.
So it sounds to me, John, that not only are you a practitioner in this genre or these genres, but you're also a great aficionado, a great lover of the art.
Oh, certainly, certainly. I was a fan, and I still am. I'm an unrepentant fanboy. I love this stuff.
Good stuff. Now, listen, one of the things that in science fiction or fantasy genres, which people often overlook, is that they are often to do with or one of the freedoms. You were talking about that elbow room that, that authors have in this genre. There's also a freedom to explore ideas that sometimes you don't get in, say, detective novels. There's a lot of philosophy sometimes in science fiction. There's a lot of future views of the world, how it's going to turn up, either dystopian, as you say, or utopian. But would you say, I mean, you're a convert to the Catholic faith. Would you say that the philosophy, the theology of the Catholic faith sort of permeates the worlds in which you've created?
Yes. I wish you'd ask me a more difficult question.
Is it a spirit of optimism? In what ways would it differentiate from, say, the likes of H.G. Wells, who was an avowed atheist whose worlds are rather bleak, or some of the other people you've mentioned, you know, who have a Gnostic view of the world or a view that good and evil are somehow interchangeable or whatever? I mean, in what ways would it manifest itself? Or do you all your novels conclude with sort of truth and goodness winning out in the end?
I prefer optimistic endings to pessimistic endings, but I'll point out that Christianity both has a very optimistic side, more optimistic than any other philosophy or religion on earth, and a very pessimistic side, more pessimistic than any philosophy or religion on earth, because we think this world and all of its glories are all vanity and rubbish that's going to be burned, but we also think that the country of joy is waiting for us. And we're going to be sit down at the feast of the Lamb and be given a wine cup filled with the water of life, okay, forever. So there's hardly any way to get either a better or a worse ending, one for the world and one for the world beyond this world. So to answer your question, I would say the difference, and I can't speak of myself because it's too difficult to talk of myself. Like I said, I write more by inspiration than calculation. But I will say Gene Wolfe is a Catholic science fiction author. So is R.A. Lafferty.
Yes.
And so is Tim Powers. And if you read their books and compare them with, let's say, H.G. Wells or Robert Heinlein, the big difference you'll find out is that Heinlein is shallow and these other authors are deep. It's not as if they don't deal with the same issues. Severian, the autarch, who is the hero of Gene Wolfe's Shadow of the Torturer, has as many sexual flings and adventures as any one of Robert Heinlein's characters, who impregnates many women throughout the galaxy. But Heinlein deals with the whole human problem of sexuality in the most shallow and juvenile possible way, you know, whereas Gene Wolfe deals with it with all of its pain, sorrow, and depth. And he also hints at the divine union that the marriage is supposed to be pointing toward, if that makes sense what I'm saying.
Yes.
He gets almost platonic about how certain beauties lead higher and higher to the divine, which is a platonic idea, which is even older than Christianity, but which Christianity clearly confirms as being true. So the answer is Christian writers are deeper because we tend to deal with things both more optimistically and more pessimistically than atheist writers. Atheism springs from a desire to deal only with the surface appearances of reality. You try to be an atheist is a skeptic who says, I'm only going to believe in what my eyes can see. You know, and then the Christian has to say, well, Mr. Skeptic, is skepticism something your eyes can see? What makes that true?
I mean, it's interesting what you say, because I mean it's been a well worn that there's quite a hefty representation of Catholics in the history of sci-fi, you know, that they're quite well there and thereabouts. But I mean, the sci-fi genre per se has, would you suggest, it's a bit like you mentioned detective fiction at the start, or crime fiction. These are termed genre fictions in the literary world, and are often, I wouldn't say looked down upon, but certainly pigeonholed by more mainstream literary endeavors. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that the genres which are so popular are the ones that they pigeonhole, whereas literary fiction, which is not that popular, are the ones that always get the prizes and the plaudits and what have you? Is this just sort of literary snobbery, or what is it?
I would say that they do look down their nose at genre fiction. I would not, unlike you, I would not clear my throat before saying that. It's obvious that they do. It is also obvious that it's snobbery, but the snobbery comes from somewhere. The snobbery comes from early magazines in the late Victorian era, both in England and America, which decided that socialism was a better worldview than the Western civilization worldview of Christendom. Mm-hmm. So the stories of Christendom always contained elements of the supernatural. Look at the witches in Shakespeare, or the ghost in Hamlet, or the mm-hmm. or the visions of Dante as he ascends
Indeed.
To heaven, and on and on and on. Okay, it is that those things are the norm. What happened was in the early industrial era, a certain rather small group of very snobbish socialist editors decided only to publish in the literary magazines in America and in Britain stories that didn't contain any elements of the fantastic, any elements of adventure, any elements of the exotic, but they wanted to tell stories about the common man, because the common man was the marching banner of the socialists in those days. They wanted to tell stories about everyday life, and they wanted them to be socially relevant. And when they, by socially relevant, they meant propaganda promoting their view of the world. So stories about poor people in Oklahoma were given the spotlight, and stories about action adventure heroes fighting crime, or people getting involved in mysterious Oriental assassin cults, were simply brushed aside, you see. Even though, technically speaking, it takes more wit and witticism to write a detective story, because you have to keep track of all your clues and red herrings, than it does to write a story about a middle-class teacher who's thinking of having an affair with a student and feels guilty, or whatever it is that mainstream writers read about. See, the problem is, it's all a trick. The mainstream is actually the people deviating from the mainstream of Western literature. They're not in the same camp as Homer and Virgil and Milton and the stories of Robin Hood, but I am, you see. Uh-huh. They're the ones who left behind the fantastical because they wanted to promote a secular worldview. So there's no wonder that Catholicism is overrepresented in science fiction, because our worldview is filled with splendor and wonder and terror and horror. We believe in the devil, you know, and they don't. So what do they believe in? Man. Okay, man is nice. This world, now. They don't even write historical fiction in the mainstream, by and large. Historical fiction leads you too closely into fantasy. In fact, old time weird tales and old-time fantasy stories, some of them would just be straight historical fiction. It would just be a worldview other than the world that we know, you know?
Mm-hmm. You're listening to John C. Wright, a sci-fi fantasy author, live here on the Turley Frequency this morning. John, I mean, it's very interesting what you're saying there, because, I mean, we are at the 100 years ago, I suppose, that literary modernism really went center stage with the likes of Joyce's Ulysses and various other Proust. It was published in English, and Ezra Pound and this. And you're absolutely right. The sort of way in which the world was changed then was away from anything heroic or dramatic to a sort of internal world of misery and introspection, I guess, which is also to do with, I guess, the loss of faith. But you found your faith along the way, because you're actually a Catholic convert. Wait, how long ago was it that you converted to the faith?
Correct. I don't remember the year. I think it was 2003-ish. It was when my children were still young.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I have time to tell you the whole conversion story, but I'll tell you the sum up is, there was two parts to it. There was a supernatural part and there was a natural part, and the natural part came first. The natural part was that as an atheist, I was very rigorous in my thinking. I was very careful and very logical, because science fiction had a big influence on my life, and I wanted to be like Mr. Spock from Star Trek. I wanted to be stoical and disciplined and a duty-bound, and I thought the duty of a philosopher was to seek the truth no matter what his emotions said. Now, having been influenced by Robert Heinlein, who I also mentioned, I was a person who believed in the libertine theory of human behavior. I believed that whatever two consenting adults consented to together was licit, was lawful. Okay? Now, if you think about that logically, those two points of view can't match, because you can't base your philosophy on pure emotion, especially the sexual emotions of lust, and base it on pure duty, because duty would say that you have to be chaste, okay? So, step by step, and very much against my will, I slowly came to believe that self-control of the sexual passions was a necessity. That meant that homosexuality was not licit, which is shocking to me, because I was raised to believe otherwise. That means that sex outside of marriage is not licit, which is a shock to me, because I was raised to believe otherwise. And the only thing that makes sex outside of marriage even possible is widespread contraception. So very much against my will, and for purely secular reasons, without a single trace or iota of religious sentiment in my mind, because I was a avowed atheist. I was actually a proselytizing atheist. I used to talk people out of believing in God, okay? I thought it was my mission to dispel what at that time I regarded as a base superstition. Well, when I came to the conclusion, when logic, against my will, forced me to the conclusion that contraception was evil, I looked around at the world and I saw there's only one group that agreed with me. It wasn't just my hated enemies, the Christians. It was the most conservative, most absurd, most Christian of all Christians, the Roman Catholic Church. And I said, wait a minute, that can't be. How could I come to their conclusions? You know, after trying to be as rigorous as possible, I said, okay, I have to give this Christianity a second look, because how can it be possible that they're right about not just that point, but everything? How can they be right about everything and be wrong about God? So I decided to do an empirical experiment. So I prayed, and I got down on my knees. I made sure none of my atheist friends could see me. I got down on my knees with no one looking. And I said, dear God, I know, because I can prove with certainty, the certainty of a geometer, I can prove that you do not exist. Okay? Nonetheless, as a philosopher, I'm forced to entertain the hypothetical possibility that I could be mistaken. So just in case I am, please reveal yourself to me in some fashion that will prove your case. If you don't answer, I can safely assume that either you don't care whether or not I believe in you, or you have no power to produce the evidence to persuade me. So if you don't care, then you're not benevolent, which means you're not God. And if you don't have the power, you're not omnipotent, which means you're not God. So in either case, you're unworthy of any worship. So I lose nothing but a bit of my dignity if I pray to you, and if you don't answer, then I'm done with you. Thank you in advance for your cooperation in this matter. Signed, John C. Wright. I didn't know much about praying at the time. I didn't know you were supposed to say signed at the end. Well, the next day I had a heart attack and sent me to the hospital. And while I was there, I was visited by the Virgin Mary, and I had a number of other experiences after that. Prayers answered. I saw Christ. He said to me, I will not be your judge at the end of the world. Yes?
We're going to have to pull this to a close. It's been fascinating. Where can people find out more about you and your writing?
You can find me at John C. Wright, at scifiwright.com. The scifiwright.com is my website.
John, it's been an absolute pleasure and a fascinating one speaking to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
When we come back, we are going to be talking Divine Mercy, and we are going to be praying that with you. Any intentions, still time to get them in. Back after these words.